Good morning. So, last time we went over some logistics. We'll have a little extra logistics about department accounts in a bit. And a preview generally of what we'd be doing this semester. We talked about the layers of abstraction we'd be going through, going from C through assembly, which you've seen before, down to machine code, which you've sort of seen before, and talking about how we implement hardware, and also going back sort of up the layers to talk about choices we can make in implementing hardware that can make our programs more efficient, how as programmers we might care about that, and things we can do in hardware to make it easier to write things like operating systems that run multiple programs at once. So things we'll talk about later in the semester. And then we talked about a different topic of reviewing powers of two. Looked at sort of the general view of the processor, which reads some instructions from memory, does what that instruction says, possibly reading or writing more things from memory, and then going on to the next instruction, where basically our processor is a machine which sends these signals to the memory on what we call the bus to read and write values. And how it interprets those values depends on what the instructions it's reading says and why it's reading that value. Is it reading it because the instruction said to jump there, or because it said to add that value from memory, determines the interpretation. We mentioned that we also needed I/O devices, and from a high level point of view, we can think of them as being connected the same sort of way as memory. We send a request with something like an address, but instead of the address representing a particular byte in memory, it represents a particular thing like a keyboard or some other thing we want to communicate with. Then we went on to talking about how real programs are run, looking at, briefly reviewing the issue of endianness, which you might remember from 2150, because we have memory as bytes, and when we look at the instructions we're used to, they often deal with things like 4 or 8 byte values, and we need to decide how does that work when our memory is just bytes. We talked about the general layout of programs, and we mentioned that we had our conventional layout where we had a stack which grew towards lower addresses, that's smaller addresses, and we had our heap which grew in the other direction, and we had our code plus globals, and this was loaded from the executable. And we were starting to go into the idea of, well, how do we produce that executable in the right form? And this is talking about the process of linking, that we have code not just from one C file, but say from multiple C files, which need to end up in the way where we can just load it into that piece of memory and it's ready to run. It has all our global variables set up and our constant data and our machine code all set up to run correctly. So, and we'll go back to that in a bit. So any questions on things we covered last time before I move on? Okay. So first, a brief logistics notes. So we have asked for department accounts for everyone who is registered as of Tuesday. So you should have one. You should be able to SSH into portal.cs.virginia.edu. There are instructions on the website. There's a link for the first lab, for the lab day this week, which points to getting C, and the first link is how to SSH and SCP that has instructions for accessing the various ways to access the department machines. Unlike previous semesters, we now have password recovery without sending an email to our IT staff. So if you don't remember your password, use that. Also, if you had a department account last semester, that you should still have one, and you would not have gotten an email about getting a department account for this semester because you still have one with the same password. If you don't remember that password, there's a password reset tool. If you don't have a department account, contact us. We will work on fixing that, preferably before Wednesday, just to make sure you can definitely do the lab on next week. So any questions about this? Okay. So let's go on to where we were last time. So last time we were talking about our process of taking our C program, and we know we were going to convert this into an assembly file. You've seen this probably before, a while ago in 2150. And we mentioned that I'm showing here, and I'll show for pretty much all of today, assembly in AT&T syntax, which is a little different than what you might be used to. I'm going to use that throughout this course because our textbook uses it, because we'll be using tools which use it, because it's the default on Linux, which is what the environment, and on OS X, which is what most people, you will end up using a Linux environment or maybe an OS X environment for all our assignments which involve looking at assembly. So we want you to be more used to this, but this is the equivalence. The main difference is just the order of operands, and we'll talk about all the differences in more detail later. So we have, in this file, we have a text part, which is, text is just a bad historical name for the code part, and we have the data part. And after we assemble this, we need to turn this into an object file. So the assembler is going to take this assembly, it's going to get rid of all the human readable terms like subtract, EAX, RDI, which well aren't really human readable, but the raw machine code form is going to use a number to represent those things. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to say, well, we have a bunch of these instructions, and we're going to write out these instructions into assembly. Machine code. And this is an example of the machine code. Here I've written it out in hexadecimal. In the real file, they're not going to write it out in hexadecimal just because that would take up a lot of extra space. And we also have this data part, so we're also going to write that out. Here I've written it out in hexadecimal. Again, in the real file, it's not going to be in hexadecimal. We're just going to put the byte for H, the byte for E, as it's going to appear in memory. So you wrote out the text in the data segment. And when we're doing this, we don't actually have the complete information we need to do that. So here I've highlighted some correspondence. So like for some things, like this subtract instruction here, that's going to be straightforward. So you can just write out the machine code for the subtract instruction, which I promise you is that valid x86-64 machine code for subtract 8 from RSP, though we're not going to talk about why it's that. But then we have some things which are a little trickier. So for example, the next instruction is to move into RDI the address of .lstring, which is the string hello world. And when we're producing this object file, we don't know where that's going to be in memory. We haven't decided yet. And it depends on what other things we need to put in memory, because remember, we're laying out memory where we're going to have this code plus constants part, and in there we're going to have like, we're going to have main, we're going to have, you know, printf, main.o or hello.o, printf.o. We're going to have a bunch of different thing, files, data, and code we're going to need to put somewhere, and we don't know where that is yet. And because we don't know, when we produce an object file, the assembler doesn't actually put the address of the string here. Instead, it just put a placeholder. And in this case, it just wrote all zeros rather than the address of the string because it doesn't know it. So it just puts something there to fill in the blank space. And we did the same thing later on for puts. We know that there's going to be another file later on that we're going to link in which has the implementation of puts, but we don't know where it is yet. We don't know how big it's going to be. So instead of writing the address of puts, we put in a placeholder in the call instructions machine code. So question.
So how does it know the size of the placeholder?
So the question is, how does it know the size of the placeholder? So they just have a rule that the size is always the same, that we're always using an instruction for this move, which is always going to have a 4-byte placeholder, and for this call, which is going to have a 4-byte placeholder. And this is a choice that they made when in the assembler, basically. And you'll need to tell the assembler to do something different if you want to make a different choice. Okay. So we have these placeholders, and it's not enough to just have the object file have those placeholders left open, because later on, something's going to need to read that object file and fill those in. So we need to have the information to do that, and we're not going to like go back to the assembly file and figure out where the placeholders were. That would be very inconvenient. That would kind of defeat the point of producing this object file. Why would we bother? We have to like read the whole thing to find puts. So we're going to write down the placeholders, and those are called relocations. So we're going to write a list of instructions for later on, saying that 6 bytes in, so 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, did I not count right? Oh, sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. This is one base counting. 4, 5, 6. So 6 bytes in is the 0. So we're saying 6 bytes in. I need that, when we're done, to point to wherever the data part ends up in memory. I don't know the address yet, but later on, this is something we're going to need to do. So I write a note for later on in the object file saying that. And similarly, 10 bytes in, we have the placeholder for the puts. We write a note saying, sometime later on, you're going to need to replace that placeholder with the actual address of puts. So these are called relocations. Conceptually, we're doing the work to move this code to the right place in memory, is the idea. And that's the name. So we just write a bunch of notes for every time we had some blank where we didn't know the address yet that we left that way. And later on, we're going to read it. And when we read it, we're going to have to know where puts is, for example. And we're going to use that information. Yes? So the question, so in this case, I started at 1.
And your 10 is not in space 10.
What? 2, 7, 8, 9. Oh, I was inconsistent, and no one has noticed this in past semesters. Yeah. So this is not the actual format things appear in the object file. I'm simplifying things a bit. I'll talk about some ways I am. But we write notes like this, which are very mechanical for where we need to do replacements. So we need some other information. So there's one thing we need to know about this assembly file later on to produce the executable that I haven't written down yet. Can someone tell me what that is? Something I need to know that's in the assembly file that if I don't write it down and I forget about it, I'm going to have a real hard time producing the executable. So I have the machine code, I have the placeholders where I left zeros. There's one other piece of information that's going to be really important to run the executable that I haven't written down. So no one sees it? Yes. So you're saying the stuff from standard IO.h, so maybe there might be some stuff there that's not actually going to be necessary, something which is even more important than that. It turns out that call puts is enough to know where puts is, but that is indeed not obvious. Yeah? No? Okay, so the piece of information we need to know is we need to know about this. We need to know where main is. Or else, how do we, when we produce the executable, make sure main gets started? So there's another piece of information we need to know, which is where main is. So this is going to be stored in what's called the symbol table. We'll call main the name of anything, a function or a global variable, a symbol. And we need to know where those are. So we need to know where main is. So later on, when we make the executable, we know where do we actually run main. Because it could have been anywhere in the machine code otherwise. We wouldn't have a way of knowing. Or could have been defined in a different file, and we wouldn't know. So that's the other piece of important information we need to know. And when we combine this with the file which contains puts, this is going to tell us where puts is, or else we're not going to be able to do our work of producing the executable. So this is our object file. So we have the relocations for those placeholders. And we have the symbol table to tell us where the names we're going to need elsewhere, like main, are going to be. And when we want to produce an executable, this is going to be done by the linker. And the linker is going to take a bunch of these object files and it's going to use all the symbol tables to figure out where like main is, where putS is, everything we might need for these placeholders. And it's going to go through all the relocations based on how it lays out the program. So it's going to decide, for example, that we're going to put hello.o code followed by standard io.o code followed by hello.o data followed by standard io.o data. So it's going to decide how to lay out the program. And because we don't know like how big standard io.o is, we can't know where all the things in memory are going to be until we do this. But after it decides where it's going to put all the code and data, then it knows the addresses of everything. So it knows, for example, what the address of main will end up being and what the address of putS will end up being based on the symbol table and where it put standard io.o's code. And it can fill in all the relocations. So it does that, and then it writes this out into the executable. So most of the executable is just going to be a bunch of data we can just copy into memory directly without any processing. So any questions about this process? So this is what linking does. So this is what's in object files, which most of you, like, you saw object files in 2150. You, like, wrote make files or copied make files without understanding what they were doing. And this is what those object files were and why they allow you to do this separate compilation. Because now the important thing is that I can replace putS with a different implementation of putS, and I don't reproduce hello.o, which is where most of the work went as far as what I was doing. The work I have to do after I have hello.o is very simple. I just figure out the addresses of a small list of things and fill in the small list of links. Okay, so no questions about this? Yeah?
So if you choose a different implementation of putS, do you have to relink everything?
So the question is, if I do choose a different implementation of putS, do I have to redo this linking process? Yeah, with the picture I have here, yes. We'll talk about an exception later. Other questions? Okay, so since there are no questions, let's on to, so here I have a simple program called main.c. I produced main.s. the assembly file, which I can turn into an object file, main.o, which I then turn into an executable, main.exe. I want to know which files are likely to contain the memory address, that's the address, you know, in memory when the program runs, of say hello. So I'll give you a minute to think about this. You can talk with your neighbor if you like to see if you agree. Thank you. Okay. Who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer is A? B? C? Okay. D? Okay. E? F? Okay, someone want to defend their answer? Seem to have a split between C and D. Yeah, so the linker is the step where we decide where to put things in memory. So importantly, when we think about this program, we could lay it out main.o, standard io.o, or we could lay it out in the other order. And that's going to mean that say hello has a different address depending on which one we choose. And if we haven't made that choice until we made the executable, then we can't actually have the memory address inside anything but the executable. So that's why we probably don't have the memory address in the sense of like the actual address it's going to end up inside main.o. Now, of course, we have references to say hello in main.o. We're going to know where in the file say hello is. That's going to be stored, but that's not the actual address when we load it into memory. So probably C is the most obvious answer. You could also make a case for F because maybe we don't know that we actually need a call instruction to do this, which has the memory address in it, in which case maybe we never write the memory address in any of these. But when we make the object file, we don't actually know where say hello is going to be in memory, so we can't have the final memory address reliably in there. So if it's going to be anywhere, it's in the executable, and maybe we can, if we have some clever way of calling say hello without its address, then maybe we don't even need it there. Okay, so how about another question? So which of these files contain the string hello world? Meaning, to clarify, let's say I open up each of these files in a text editor. So I open up main.s in a text editor. I open up main.o in a text editor. Which of them would you expect to see hello world exclamation point in that text editor? And I'll give you a minute for this one. More time? Okay, so who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so we have a scatter of answers here. Anyone want to defend any answer? tell me something, it's definitely in. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying in the assembly file is the easiest, and the easiest way to see it is, do you see hello world in here anywhere? Yes, you do. So it's probably there. Like, maybe it's not guaranteed. Maybe the compiler decides to be really clever, and instead of writing this dot string like that, it writes dot byte, you know, I forget what the ASCII for H is. It could do that, yes. Technically, it doesn't have to do it, but it's unlikely. So maybe it's not guaranteed it's in the assembly. So in the object file, we want to have the linker do minimum work. So typically, the object file format is just going to have the bytes we're going to end up putting in memory. And when it's in memory, we know it's in ASCII, because that's how characters in C work, C and C++ work. So we know in the object file, it's going to be in that format. And the executable is just loaded blindly into memory, so if the string is in our memory when we're writing the program, it's going to be in the executable, so it's going to be there. So it's definitely in the O and exe file, and probably in the .s file, unless the compiler is needlessly obtuse. Okay, so any questions about this? Yeah. It's also in the C file. Yeah, so you could argue F for that one. Yes, it is in the C file. Just didn't ask about that one. Other questions, comments? Okay. That's about linking. So I gave you a kind of simplified view of linking, and there are two big things I glossed over. So one thing is I said here that we have these placeholders, like so, and I just implied we put the address there. Sometimes the machine code doesn't work that way. So for example, in x86, in real x86 machine code, the call instruction actually usually doesn't have an address, but it says call the functions that this many bytes later or earlier in memory. But we use the same procedure, we just leave a blank, but instead of putting the address in the blank, we compute the difference. And there's going to be something in the relocation saying a relocation type. So you might see this in some places if you look at object files. And that's just going to tell you, do I have to compute the difference or put an address here? Is it a 4-byte blank or is it an 8-byte blank? So I mentioned that there was that choice the assembler made about like the size of the blanks. That's how the linker knows about that. The assembler can write that down with the relocation. Probably the more confusing thing that I didn't mention is dynamic linking. So what I described here is that when we produce the executable, all the code is in the executable, and that we just load it into memory and we're done. And it turns out that real systems often don't work that way. They've decided that that's too early to figure everything out, so they instead do what's known as dynamic linking. So what we talked about was static linking. And that's not the default with GCC or Clang. You have to specify minus static. So by default, they do something different, where they do the same kind of process of filling in some blanks, but they don't do it when we produce the executable, but they only do it when we load the executable. But it's the same idea. There's a bunch of relocation saying what blanks to fill in, and we do it as we load the executable. And the idea is that we can have the library as a separate file. So here I have libc.so, which contains our copy of printf, and that's a separate file. And the advantage of this is now I have, say, ls, which uses printf, and emacs, which uses printf, and I only have one copy of printf on my system. I don't have to have a copy in every single program. Instead, I can just have one copy. And if I find a bug in printf, I can update one file and not recompile and not relink every single program on my system that uses printf. And the typical way you'll see this work, and I'm mentioning this because we're going to have you do an assignment where you look at assembly for the lab, is that they add extra indirection. So you'll often, to make the linking easier, not because you couldn't like do the same thing I showed you earlier, replace the calls with a call to look up in a function table. So we'll have a table of the addresses, and the linker will fill in that rather than changing all the call instructions. This is not because we couldn't change all the call instructions, it's just because this is faster overall. So questions about this notion of dynamic linking? So the key idea is we're doing the same sort of substitution, but just when we load the executable rather than when we produce it. And this is mainly so we can avoid having lots of copies of printf sitting around on our disk and other things that all sorts of applications use. So instead, they just load the one copy of printf on the system when they start. Questions? I'm used to people being very confused by this stuff. Okay. So most applications on Linux and most other operating systems use dynamic linking. And on Linux, there's a tool called LDD, which stands for Loader Diagnostic. I don't remember anymore. But LDD is a command line tool which will tell you what dynamically linked libraries does an application use. And it's usually more than you expect. So this is telling me that ls, this is binls, which is the ls command. It has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 libraries it loads. And it tells me what files it gets them loaded from and where it ends up putting them in its program memory. And this is the list for ls. For bigger programs, it gets surprisingly large. And these are all things which are loaded at runtime when ls starts. Okay, so questions? So any questions about linking in general? So this is where I'm concluding talking about linking. Yes? So the question is, on Windows, is this what DLL files? Yes. So on Linux, we have this .so extension, so .o stands for object file, and .so stands for shared object file. So it's like a .o, but it's shared between multiple programs. And on Windows, the equivalent thing is called .dll for dynamically linked library. And they are exactly equivalent to this. The way they work internally is a little bit different, but not from the perspective of what we're talking about. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is inheritance built off this kind of principle? Not really. So the implementation of inheritance is, obviously it relies on having code loaded that you didn't know about. So for example, if you think of plugins in a browser or something like that, that's based on this sort of thing. Like loading things or extensions to a game or something like that. That might be based on this sort of thing. But inheritance itself, we often implement that without having separate libraries for everything. And the way that works is more about writing your assembly to not call functions directly, but to look up in a table. Okay, other questions? Okay, so our next topic then is going to be assembly. And as I mentioned, we're going to be using tools that use AT&T syntax assembly, and our textbook uses, AT&T syntax assembly. So I'm going to go over reading AT&T syntax assembly, given that you might kind of remember Intel syntax assembly a bit. So they're different. So I have the AT&T syntax over here, and the Intel syntax over here. And I'll go over all the differences here in a bit. Okay. So let's start with a simple example. So here I have a move instruction that moves the value 42 to a sort of notably an 8-byte place in memory determined by the value of the register RBX. In AT&T syntax, we have this is move Q $42 and parentheses around RBX. In Intel syntax, this is move into Q word pointer. The Q word is not optional because we need to know how big a thing we're moving of 42. So let's go over the pieces of the AT&T syntax part that you haven't seen before. So one thing to note is that the destination is last. And this is going to be always true. Even in cases where you're going to say, that's silly, it's still true. So the destination is always last. A mnemonic you might use for that is you might write this, think of writing an arrow for the comma to point the direction the data flows. And we use parentheses here to represent using something as an address in memory. So the parentheses around RBX means we're moving into a place in memory and not into RBX itself. We also have constants, and we always start constants with a dollar sign. If we don't start it with a dollar sign, as we'll talk about later, it means it's a memory address and we're reading from memory. So we need a dollar sign there to say this is a constant. Similarly, we always start registers with a percent sign. If we don't start it with a percent sign, it's a label somewhere else in the assembly file, like our string hello world or something like that. Yeah?
Would you say that the parentheses are dereferencing the register?
So you can think of the parentheses as dereferencing. This is maybe not the least confusing way when we talk about how labels work and how the parentheses work with doing things like accessing a memory at RBX plus some offset. We also have suffixes on the instruction. So in this case, we don't have move, we have move Q. And we can put a suffix on instructions to indicate the length. So Q means quad for 8 bytes. So why quad? Well, when we were coming up with this, the 16-bit version of Intel was the de facto one. So it's 8 times. So it's 4 times the 16-byte value. And we have other names: L for long, and W for word, and B for byte. So if we wanted to move only 32 bits, we'd use move L instead of move Q. If we wanted to move 16 bits, we'd use move W instead of move Q, and move B for moving 1 byte. And you can sometimes omit these. So in this instruction, we need the suffix, because otherwise we don't know whether it's not gonna be clear whether 42 is a 1 byte value or 16 bit value or so on. I think there's a default, but I wouldn't recommend relying on it. So here the suffix like tells us what to do. In cases where it's obvious, like we'll commonly omit it. So for example, if I do this, well, it's obviously 64 bits because RDX is a 64 bit register. So I don't need to say, I can write move Q, but it's not necessary. So questions about what you see so far? Yeah?
Can you explain the difference between an address and a label?
So an address and a label?
Yeah.
Generally, when we use a label, it means the address, it's that they're the same as far as you're concerned, it's just a different way of specifying an address. So, So this is the more intuitive part. So now we get to the part which usually annoys people, which is this here. So here I have move 42 into, this is 100 memory at 100 plus RBX plus RCX times 4. And it is written this way in AT&T syntax assembly, whereas you're used to an Intel syntax having to writing out this sort of arithmetic expression. So the advantage of this is that it's much harder to accidentally write something which isn't a real instruction, because you have to fill in all those blanks. You can't accidentally write something like RBX plus RCX plus RDX, which is not an instruction on x86. But the disadvantage is that this is less intuitive. Yes. And this will mostly come up in our first assignment where you're looking at compiler-generated assembly. Maybe a little bit later on you might look at some of compiler-generated assembly. Generally, when we're writing assembly, we won't be taking much advantage of the three-argument form, but it might come up now and then. So the rule is that we have our constant, which goes before the parentheses, which is added to the address. So this is why I said it's confusing later on to think of it, the parentheses, as dereferencing. This is why, because even though it's outside the parentheses, it's used to compute the address. Then we have what we call our base, our index, and our scale. So RBX is called the base, so we use RBX, we add that with the constant, plus the index times the scale. And there's a rule here that the scale has to be 1, 2, 4, or 8. Those are the only options you can use for the scale. And base and index have to be a register. Yes?
Can you put parentheses around RCX and access memory inside of that?
So the question is, can I do something like RBX parentheses RCX 4? And the answer is no. These have to be registers, no adornments, just registers. If you want to do what you're trying to do there, you'll need more instructions. Other questions? Yeah.
What do you mean by base index?
So this is the name, so we call this the base register because we use it to form the base of the addresses conceptually. So this is names you'll see sometimes. And you call the second one the index because if you think of this as accessing an array, we can say the array starts at the base address and we have index elements, each of which are, in this case, 4 bytes into that is what we're accessing. And that notion of accessing an array is sort of what the Intel designers chose this way of producing memory addresses based on. Yeah?
Do both the base and the index have to be registers?
Yes. They have to either be registers or omitted. And we'll talk about omitting them on the next slide. Other questions? Okay, so this is the most general form, and you can omit things, and we already saw that earlier with the simple example of parentheses RBX, which was memory at RBX. So we can omit the base, the index, and scale, but still have an offset, that thing to add to the address in front. If we omit the offset, it defaults to 0. We can have only the index and the scale, so these two are equivalent, in which case we just take the offset added to that register times the scale factor. We can have all of them. And we can also omit the scale factor, in which case this is sort of equivalent to if we specified comma one as our string. So the scale you can think of as defaulting to one. And we also have this sort of the less intuitive case. So I mentioned that constants start with a dollar sign. If you don't write a dollar sign, we just use it as a memory address. So this means that move 100 into RAX is going to access memory at address 100 and put it in RAX, whereas move $100 into RAX is going to actually load the value 100 into RAX. So just make sure you don't write the wrong one, or else it's very confusing. So any questions about the sort of idea that basically we can omit the index, we can omit the registers, in which case they default to zero, basically, and we can omit the scale, in which case it defaults to one. And those all work and still access memory. Questions? Okay. So that's on addressing. So there's another thing which is very important, which is how the order of operands works. I mentioned the destinations always last, and there's one case where this is true that a lot of people don't like. And that's this, subtract. It's the same instruction, but the destination is last. So you can think of subtract RAX from RA. It's the way I would think about it, but it's not probably not the order you're used to. And this also applies to the compare instruction. So the compare instruction is the opposite of what you've seen in Intel syntax assembly. So questions on this? This is mostly thing to remember, which comes up a bunch. And yes, I know it's confusing. This is probably the most annoying part about AT&T syntax. And I already mentioned the issue of constants, just reminding you that you need to write constants. And this matters for more than just move instructions. So for example, if you want to add hex 1000, one of these is adding the constant, the other is reading memory at that address and adding that to a register. Make sure you choose the one you actually care about. So that's my summary. So questions on AT&T syntax? Okay. So an extra little detail is computed jumps. So I'm mentioning this last because you may not have seen it at all in 2150, or devs just not remember it. So you can jump to an address like of a function that's in a register, and the syntax has this dollar, this star. In AT&T assembly, in Intel, they just don't put anything there. And you can also jump to an address where you read from memory at this address to read an 8-byte value, which tells you that's where the function is. The function's not in there. So the typical use of this is that there will be a table at 1000 plus RAX, and we're reading entry RBX of it. So 1000 plus RBX points to the beginning of an array, and we want to get the plus RBX times 8 entry in there, and this is the address to go to. So there's some indirection there. It's not, we don't go start executing machine code in the table. The table tells us where the machine code we want to execute is. Does that idea make sense? I think I might have an example later. So this comes up on the homework because this is something compilers will sometimes generate, notably for switch statements. It's really handy for switch statements to do this kind of thing. If all the options are right next to each other, you just look up in a table what the case number is and find out where the code to go to for that is, rather than having a bunch of compares and conditional jumps. Questions? Okay. I'm not sure, bored or confused or those. Okay, so that's all on TNT versus Intel syntax. So to walk through this and remind you about assembly, let's just go through a quick example of a simple function with AT&T syntax. So something to remember, we have a calling convention. I'll show you, remind you what the registers for the calling convention were. We say RDI and RSA are our first two arguments. And here we have a function which takes those two arguments and swaps the things that those are pointers to. AT&T syntax. And remember, the order of arguments is different in Intel syntax. So this is what it would be equivalent to in Intel syntax. And yes, you could probably omit the keyword pointers and just write the brackets. I just wrote it out in the most expressive form of Intel syntax. So let's just step through this. So here I have some values and registers. So first thing we're going to do is we're going to use RDI as a memory address, load that value at that memory address into RAX. And we're going to then do the same thing with RSI and RDX. Then we have the opposite direction, where we're going to take the value in RDX and we're going to put it in the place that RDI specifies.
I just swapped these. So we do, this is what I get for, this is this operation. So, and I probably have the other one next, yes. So I just swapped my highlighting. So here we're taking, I'll highlight the one we're actually doing, we're taking RDX and putting it into memory at the location specified by RDI, and then we're taking RAX and putting it into memory at the location specified by RSI. And then we return, and if you remember how return works, we're gonna read a value from the stack and return to, and jump to that location. Sorry for messing up my slide order. So questions on this? This something you can step through, like do on an exam or a quiz, since we might expect you to be able to do this. Practice, yeah.
So is this function specifically for like the swapping of a keyword?
So the prototype I wrote here, the question is what type of thing does this function swap? So the prototype I have here is long star. You could use the same assembly for anything which is the same size as a long. So for example, a double could have the same assembly.
Right, so what happens if you want to swap like two strings?
So if you want to swap like two strings, you're going to need a different function. Because this is the assembly you'd expect to get for a C function like void swap long star A, long star B, that does something like long T equals
star A equals star B, and T, sorry, and star B equals T, something like that would might compile into this. But if you want to do strings, that's not the C code, it won't produce the same assembly code. Definitely can't. So other questions? Okay. So that's just review. So hopefully you could read this and figure out what's going on. So that should be enough following AT&T syntax that we won't get too confused later on. So I'm going to review some things about assembly that you like should know but might not remember. So one thing, and some things that are like little details that don't come up in 2150, which might come up on our homework assignment in our lab next week. So one thing is remember that x86 has a whole bunch of registers. We have names for the smaller parts of registers. This is the table for that. There are names for even the smaller parts of like R12, even though you don't commonly see those, but you might see them in compiler-generated assembly from now and then. Names for the byte, the lower byte of R12 is R12B, R12W is the lower 16 bits, R12D is the lower 32 bits. So these registers overlap, as you know from 2150, and there are funny rules for how they overlap. So if you're setting a 32-bit register, that clears the rest of the corresponding 64-bit register. So this code here, which writes 1 into EAX, REX ends up being 1, even though I set all its bits beforehand. But if I write into a smaller register that's part of REX, it doesn't do that. This is just an arbitrary rule, just so you don't get confused. And I'm mentioning this because it will explain some weird assembly the compiler generates. You'll be like, why is it clearing REX? This is why, usually. So you mentioned about labels. So as you may or may not remember from 2150, labels represent addresses. That's the important thing to remember. Labels. Okay. And yeah, we also mentioned, so just like we have addresses, this means that this is equivalent to writing, let's say string is at address 0x1000, this is equivalent to writing addq of 0x1000rax, which is going to read from memory the first few bytes of the string and add it to rax. This is equivalent to writing addq of the constant 0x1000, where that's the address of the string, and adding it to rax. And probably, if you ever wrote this, you'd run the latter one, which is like for computing the address of a byte in the string. Whereas the first one, you're using ASCII values as a number, that doesn't make much sense. But labels act exactly like numbers that are the memory address they end up as in assembly. And this is true for AT&T syntax. Okay. So something I know that comes up in 2150 that people don't remember very well is LEA. For load effective address. So LEA looks like a move, but it skips the memory access. It just uses the address. So you can think of this kind of like the ampersand operator in C. It like gets the address of the thing that you would access. So for example, if I LEA 4REX, if this were a move, so move 4REX into REX, would take memory at 4 plus RAX and move it into RAX. So the LEA doesn't do the memory access, so it does 4 plus RAX into RAX. This is the general rule. And you'll sometimes see compilers use this, and this often confuses people because this 4 plus REX, that's useful if REX does not represent an address. If you just want to add 4 to something, this is a convenient way of doing it in assembly. And the compiler will take advantage of this. Now, 4 plus REX, you might say, well, we have an add instruction, isn't that nicer? And
yes, it is. But there are cases where it's not nicer, where we can do better. And one example is, let's say you want to multiply something times 5. It turns out we can do that with an LEA instruction, and compilers sometimes like doing this over a multiply instruction, because it ends up being faster on most processors. Or if we want to add two registers together and put the result in a third register, if we did add instructions, we need to like move the value first and then add, because we only have two operands. But we can do them all, that all in one instruction with one LEA. So you'll see these kinds of tricks used by compilers. So questions about sort of what the code I have up here is doing, how it works. And remember, remember how this works. This is our base register and our index time scale that we're taking advantage of here. So any questions? Okay, so if there are no questions on that, you can ask a question. I'll give you a minute because you'll need to probably figure out. I'll write some stuff down. And remember that RDI, EDI is the first argument to a function by the x86 calling 64-bit calling convention. So, okay, who needs more time? People. Okay, who needs more time now? Not ready. So who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E? Okay, F? Okay, so someone wants to defend their answer. So the majority said E. Someone who chose E wanted to tell me what they think's going on. Yeah.
It multiplies RDI by 8 and moves it into EAX, and then it subtracts EI from the EAX, which leads you with 7 RDI.
Yes, so the answer is it's equivalent to arg times 7. And you will in fact see C compilers generate code assembly like this if you write that sort of function. And the way this works is that this sets EAX becomes RDI times 8. There's some truncation going on to make that happen since we have a 64-bit RDI, but that doesn't change the value. And then we take EAX, we subtract EDI from it, so it becomes EAX minus EDI. If you remember what we talked about with the order in AT&T syntax earlier. And so we get arg times 7. So any questions on that? Yes.
Why does the first line use RDI and the second line?
So the question is, why does the first line use RDI, not EDI, even though it's a 32-bit value? The answer is because this is an address computation and addresses are 64-bit, you have to use RDI there, even though you don't care about the top 32 bits. Other questions? Yeah. Why it's 7? So here, EAX becomes RDI. So there's two parts. So first part is the first line sets EAX to RDI times A. Is that okay? Or do I need to explain that? Okay. So then we have RDI times 8 minus EDI. And if this is since this function takes a 32-bit value, we know all the top bits of RDI are 0. And if RDI times 8 overflowed, it's the same thing as if we ignore the top bits when we look at EDI. And so it's the same thing. So this is RDI times 8 is the same thing as EDI times 8 as long as we are only using 32 bits of the result. And that's all we care about. Make sense? Yeah.
Who zeroed out the top 32 bits?
So the question is who zeroed out the top 32 bits? So if you remember when I talked earlier, I mentioned if you ever set a 32-bit register, you zero out the other bits. So we know they have to be zeroed. And also, the calling convention says that you're supposed to do that. I didn't write it on this slide because we usually don't talk about that sort of detail. The calling convention, in fact, won't. But one of the parts of the calling convention is going to say that even if you're passing a 1-byte argument, set the whole register. Yeah. So what I mean by the address of? So you can think of this as representing memory at RAX times 4. So, and it's the address of that is what we store in RAX, which ends up being RAX plus RAX times 4, is that's the address that accesses. That makes sense? So another way of thinking about this is address of is kind of like ampersand in C, and the memory at this is kind of like dollar sign. Or you can think of this as ampersand of memory at this, at A. Like, and if memory's address is 0, that ends up just being A. And you can think of memory as an array that starts at address 0, so it just ends up being A. Does that make a good way of thinking about it? Yeah, so this is sort of, you can think of this address of as shorthand for ampersand and memory as being, we're treating your memory like an array, we're getting the address in that array. Which is the same thing as the index in the array. So the address of and the memory at that cancel out. Okay. So I mentioned the calling convention. You'll sometimes need it. Don't memorize it. It's in the book. If you need it, you can find it at other places. We don't expect you to memorize it. And then hopefully you remember from 2150, you put things on in the registers for the arguments. You use call and return. Call uses the stack. Return pops from the stack.
And there are also rules about what registers you must preserve. Hopefully that's all reviewed from 2150. If I don't expect you to memorize what those registers are, but you should be able to look them up when you need them. And you push things either from the caller or callee, depending on which category they're in. So any questions on that? Okay, so. So one other note, since we're going to have you read assembly in a debugger, there's one thing which comes up which you haven't seen probably in 2150, which happens occasionally, which is this finding register called RIP, which isn't really a register. So this stands for the program counter, or the instruction pointer, or the program counter, and it represents the address of the next instruction, and on 64-bit x86, you'll sometimes see the compiler use this to access memory. Just because it makes it more convenient for things like libraries, which you might not want to load into the same place every time. And confusingly, in assembly, if you write label parentheses RIP, you would think that would take label, whatever the address of that is, plus the address of the program counter. It doesn't. It's just an exception. I'm sorry. It's just the equivalent. It just uses a different machine code to do the same thing. So next time, we're going to talk about a bunch of translating C to assembly and how conditional jumps actually work in x86. So one thing I'd like to note before we do that, I still have 2 minutes, thank you, is that C supports GoTo. Yes, this is a real feature in C. Do I recommend using it all the time? No. Here I've shown you one of the best applications for GoTo in C, which is if you want to break out of nested loops, it is a way of doing it. And this has a very straightforward assembly translation. We can turn the GoTo into a jump, and the label later on, yes, the labels are valid C syntax, into a label. You can think of it working that way. And we're going to use this in this class because it's the easiest way of thinking about how do I translate C to assembly, is I can translate into C with GoTos, and then translate that line by line into assembly. So there's just a straightforward translation here. This is going to be a compare and a jump less than. This is going to be an add. This is going to be a jump. This is going to be a mul. Like, I can just do that very mechanically, and that's how we'll think about translating things, and that's what we'll talk about next time, is translating if-then and loops to assembly and looking at what compilers do in that case a little bit.